Welcome to the Capital Connection, a weekly program questioning New York State leaders on a variety of issues. Your host is Dr. Alan Chartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Distribution of the Capital Connection is made possible with the help of New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org. And NISCASA, the New York State Coalition Against Sexual Assault, working to support men in their decisions to end sexual violence with the My Strength Is Not For Hurting campaign, online at nyscasa.org.
Welcome to the Capital Connection. I'm Alan Chartok. Joining us today is New York State Attorney General Eric Schneiderman, a Democrat who previously served in the New York State Senate. Attorney General Eric Schneiderman, welcome back to the program.
Good to be back.
General, as we sometimes say, what's the Conviction Review Bureau and why did you do it?
The Conviction Review Bureau is an idea that came out of, work I did when I was appointed by then-Governor Spitzer to the Sentencing Review Panel, where we reviewed all of New York's sentencing laws, looked at other systems around the country, and came away with a sense that we really did need to have better systems in place to make sure that any time a prosecutor is concerned that there may have been something, mistake made or a wrongful conviction for any reason, that you have the resources and you have the ability to take that second look. Now, since then, several of the larger DA's offices in the state, Cy Vance in New York County and Joe Hines in Kings County, have set up their own internal second look conviction integrity operations. But we came across this really because in the state of New York, the Attorney General has to defend all of the claims for monetary damages. After someone is exonerated, then they sue the state of New York for penalties for keeping them locked up for a long time. That's my office's job to defend. We have people with some expertise in these cases. We decided to formalize this, dedicate a few people to this, review our own procedures and make sure we're following best practices, and then came up with the idea that we're going to also make that bureau, these lawyers with expertise, available to any district attorney's office in the state that need someone to take a second look at a case, because in many counties you have very small offices and it's very, very challenging even if someone wants to take a look. This is another resource for people to use, call on, to make sure that whenever there is a good suspicion, a grounded suspicion that someone may have been wrongfully convicted, that it's not for a lack of resources that we're not digging in and taking a look. And we're very excited about it. The head of the DA's Association, Janet DeFiore, spoke up in favor of this, as a group of my colleagues across the state. And I think it's an important part of a much greater movement. There's a lot more work being done now on issues related to best police practices and real active concern about the reality of wrongful convictions that is being acknowledged more than it ever was. The District Attorneys Association has a best practices committee that's working with DAs on how you make sure there aren't wrongful identifications by eyewitnesses, which is a huge problem. How do you deal with the issue of recording custodial interrogations? So I see this as one step in a much broader movement to ensure the integrity of our criminal justice system and to ensure that no innocent person ever goes to prison for a crime they didn't commit, which just leaves the real perpetrator out there to commit more crimes.
Eric Schneiderman, obviously the role of the district attorney is to convict. And now you've got the tricky thing on your hands of trying to convince them after they've done their job and convicted that they have to take a second look. Is that tough?
No, it's really, I have to say, I think that there's a shift in awareness. And a lot of my colleagues, I've spoken to many of them around the state as we prepared for this, are meeting with police departments, are looking at issues related to best practices, and they want to ensure, prosecutors want to ensure they have the right person. I mean, it is sometimes, I think, a little bit of a stereotype that they don't, take a second look. They take a second look on an informal basis a lot. We're just providing the resources either to consult with them if they just need some expertise or to actually launch an independent investigation. If you have an office where you only have 10 lawyers, and you may not want to have five investigating something that the other five did. So we're just providing resources to, I think, help people move in the direction they're moving in anyway. But there are advocates who have called to the attention of DAs and can call to the attention of the governor issues where there's evidence that there is someone doing time for a crime they didn't commit, and there have been cases where, through DNA evidence or otherwise, convictions have been overturned. This is just another step towards guaranteeing that no innocent person ever does time for a crime they didn't commit. And we're looking forward to collaborating with our colleagues and also to working on legislative initiatives and other reforms to ensure that New York's laws are as good as they possibly can be in ensuring the integrity of our justice system.
Okay, so let me just carry this a little bit further and say that a DA who is prosecuting a case has some doubts because they go forward, the police bring it to them, the rest of this. Can they call on you then?
This is a post-conviction review bureau. So this means the case comes in, and I think the district attorneys, you don't prosecute people if you don't think that you've got a good case. So they prosecute someone, and then things happen sometimes. And it can be very difficult because sometimes time lag makes reconstructing a case very difficult. But eyewitnesses recant their testimony. Someone else confesses to the crime. The most clear-cut cases, obviously, are DNA cases, mm-hmm. but there are a lot of cases that don't involve DNA. And if someone has exhausted their legal remedies, they've tried to appeal and do everything else they're entitled to under our existing laws, there's still an opportunity for a district attorney to reconsider. And some fairly high-profile cases that has mm-hmm. happened. I think everyone remembers the Central Park Five, the situation sure. where the district attorney did eventually acknowledge that the wrong people had been incarcerated, and that takes courage. But I think most of the DAs in the state want to do the right thing, and we do want to make sure that there's not any lingering sense that, unless you can get yourself a fancy lawyer, you get a second-class quality of justice in this state. New York State has got to be better than that. I'm a very strong believer, and it's a theme that runs through really pretty much all the work in my office, in the American idea of equal justice under law, one set of rules for everyone, and I think that ensuring the integrity of the justice system is very, very important.
So let me just take off from there for a second. Trayvon Martin, it didn't look like there was, of course, that's not a New York case, it's a Florida case, but you just piqued my interest when you said, equal justice. If the press hadn't gotten involved, if this hadn't become a cause célèbre, have you thought about the fact that maybe nothing ever would have come of charging Zimmerman?
Well, I don't like to comment on ongoing cases. I don't like it when people comment on my ongoing cases. So I don't know exactly what went on in the office of the prosecutor there. But certainly public awareness and public outcry has been important in demands for justice. And you can look at a lot of very high-profile cases in the past, the Reuben Hurricane Carter case and others, sure. where that sort of thing help mobilize people, and also, quite frankly, from just a strictly prosecutorial point of view, there are times when people come forward with evidence or people think, I really didn't see that, maybe I should say something about it, when a matter is getting more public attention. So that can play an important role in mobilizing witnesses or potential witnesses or others to take action. So it's not really that unusual. I don't really know what the details are in this case. It certainly is something that appeared to a lot of people not to have been handled fairly. And, hopefully we get the just result. The goal is to get the just result, get the facts out. And it's also important in the justice system, Alan, I believe, to restore people's confidence in the system. This is something that I've seen over and over again since I've come into office, that the public's confidence has been badly shaken in the financial services system, which I spent a lot of time working on, in the integrity of our state government, mm-hmm. integrity of elected officials, which I've also been devoting a lot of time to. But there's also an issue that there are a lot of people in New York and in America who really do think there is, there are two systems of justice in this country, and we got to get past that. Our country works as a republic. People get involved, they vote, they stay engaged if they believe that it's on the level. There's one set of rules for everyone, and that's something that I'm very committed to reestablishing as Attorney General.
We're talking to Eric Schneiderman, New York State Attorney General. We're proud to have you here, Eric, and thank you so much for doing this. You've been very, very busy. So what I want to do now is just lay out an idea, and then you'll answer, and we'll go on, because I got about six of them. So let's start with the amicus brief you just filed with the Supreme Court on the Arizona immigration law. Little background, and why did you do it?
Sure. There are states that are going in two very distinct directions relating to immigration law and policy. Arizona had passed a very harsh law targeting undocumented immigrants really have, including somewhat bizarre provisions, requiring every law enforcement officer who suspects anyone of being engaged in conduct that might subject them to deportation to detain someone and detain them until they could ascertain their immigration status, which means they have to hold someone until they could get a federal official to drop whatever they are doing and check on this person. Now, Arizona law enforcement officers are already authorized to enforce Arizona law. So this means that they're being required to act for any other law, federal law, any other law that might subject someone to deportation. It's inconsistent with federal law. The federal government has a system of prioritization for who should be deported and who shouldn't be. They're trying to target dangerous people who are criminals. This completely disrupts the federal system. There is a federal provision that requires states to work with the federal government on a cooperative basis when it comes to decisions about deportation and detention. The Arizona law violates all of these the statutes and rules of the federal government. We think it's unconstitutional, and we took the lead in a brief that's unusual from a legal point of view, because this is, we're leading a group of states that are saying, federal government, you should preempt this state. You should say that states don't have authority in this area, because the Constitution clearly provides the authority to Congress in the federal government to determine who's allowed into the country, and who's allowed in and who's allowed out are part of the same equation. So our argument is that states have authority to enact any law they want to take care of or deal with people in their borders. We can have our own policies about schooling for immigrants or whether they're entitled to social benefits or health care. But when it comes to the fundamental decision of who's allowed into the country and out of the country, you cannot have 50 different states having 50 different policies. We can't just start rounding people up in New York and putting them in a truck and dumping them over the border in Canada. And that's our contention. And it's interesting to see, as I meet with other attorneys general, that we have a group of states supporting us on this, and Arizona has some support from other states, similar to the split over the health care bill, where I was on an amicus brief in support of the federal Affordable Care Act, and there were a significant number of attorneys general who sued to strike down the signature accomplishment of the Obama administration. So this is another example of some polarization, but I think we have the winning argument, and I think that even the Supreme Court is going to support us, because it's very important that we don't have states trying to adopt their own policies on who should and shouldn't be deported and disrupting a federal system where they have to prioritize. And I think everyone would prefer for them to prioritize getting rid of dangerous undocumented immigrants instead of just having a system that was determined by whether or not any particular local law enforcement officer happened to want to question an individual who was working in their jurisdiction.
Eric Schneiderman, you have been doing very important work, unlike things we have seen in the past, of rounding up gangs in some of our cities around New York State. Some of these gangs can be terrifying to people. Are you gratified by the results?
Yes, we have, as you note, this is a new emphasis in the office. We have redoubled our efforts through our organized crime task force. And I have to emphasize that this has been a terrific collaborative project with local law enforcement, whether it's the Albany Police Department or Rochester or Buffalo, with the state police, with other agencies, including federal agencies, to collaboratively go after this, use wiretaps, use whatever methods are available to us, and really go after the gangs. I was involved in the reform of the Rockefeller drug laws, and one of the reforms that we enacted was to establish a major trafficker statute, really a drug kingpin statute. And we've been able to use that and use it effectively in a number of these cases. On March 27th, we unveiled a 261-count indictment of 52 members of this very violent network centered in the Albany area that was involved in trafficking drugs and involved in several shootings. These people were very violent. It was the largest takedown in the history of our office. We've also taken down major gangs in Buffalo and Rochester and Syracuse. So this has been a focus. There are some bad folks out there, and I'm a strong believer in treatment for addicts. I'm also a strong believer that major traffickers and violent gangs have to be taken down, and that's where the justice system should focus its energies. One thing that I want to note about this is that we have found, and in the Albany takedown in late March, in addition to the traditional drugs, A lot of these gangs also now are dealing in prescription narcotics, which is another major focus of my office. And we're hoping to, and I think we will in the course of the next few weeks, pass groundbreaking legislation to ensure that New York has the best program in the country to track the prescribing and distribution of prescription medication, because the prescription opioids are really becoming, it's the fastest growing drug problem in the country, and it is, organized crime increasingly is playing a role in networks that distribute drugs that start out legally but get diverted into these illegal networks. It was striking how many prescription drugs the folks we took down in March had, in addition to the traditional cocaine and heroin possession that these gangs, you know, had years ago. You would not see the kinds of problems that we see today involving drugs like hydrocodone and oxycodone in gang activity and across social groups across our state.
Talk to me about Indian Point.
Well, it's in a relicensing proceeding. We've been very active in, again, coming back to my theme of one set of rules for everyone, making sure that the utility and the NRC comply with their laws that govern them. We filed a motion demanding that the NRC comply with a federal statute which requires them to assess the potential impact on the environment of the way they're handling severe, what are called severe action mitigation measures. So Indian Point did not have an adequate plan to deal with a severe accident, and we actually got a ruling from the Atomic Safety and Licensing Board for, I think it was the first time in history that they'd ruled against the NRC and the utility, saying you have to go back and provide for plans to how to handle things from, you know, fire safety and everything else. A lot of the issues that came up in the meltdown of the Japanese reactor, or provide a compelling reason why you can't. So we are we're encouraged that we're getting results. We've filed a fire safety position with the NRC, and they've shown more receptivity than they have in the past to our critiques. We just want to make sure that all risks are being taken into account, and that this is not a rubber stamp proceeding when it comes to the relicensing. It's a dangerous place to have a power plant, and we have to make sure that all the laws and rules are enforced. And I think that if they get the right level of scrutiny, I think it's going to be a real challenge for them to get relicensed.
It scares the hell out of me. But I wanted to ask you something, Eric Schneiderman. One of the things that some major minority groups and others have been very worried about in New York State are the so-called stop and frisks. Some people call it driving while black or walking while black and the rest of it. I know that you're taking a look at the way in which the New York Police Department has been acting in all of this. Can you give us a little on that?
Well, I can't give you much because is something that is still under consideration. It's an internal matter. I think that, as you say, a lot of folks have expressed concern about this. And I think that there's an acknowledgement that the police officer's ability to stop people if they're engaged in suspicious activity and frisk them if they think there may be a danger is an important law enforcement practice. It's a legitimate law enforcement practice. The question raised has been, how are they targeting people? How many are they doing in what communities and that sort of thing. We have not made an announcement yet of what we're going to do precisely on this, but it is, I realize, there has been some speculation in the last few days about it. When we're ready to make an announcement, we will, but it is certainly an issue that's on the minds of a lot of New Yorkers.
You'll come back and talk to us about that. Now, mortgages. I know you've been after the mortgage scammers. We only have a few minutes, but where are we at?
Well, we're proceeding really on three levels at this point. The first is that we obtained a settlement of a portion of our claims that we and other states had against the big banks who were servicing mortgages, that results in us getting $130 million to provide for help for New York homeowners. Our first and most important priority is making sure that no one is ever wrongfully foreclosed on, because there have been cases where it's become evident that the foreclosing party may not have had proper title when they were foreclosing. The problem is the legal services programs to protect people against wrongful foreclosure were all set to zero out April 1st. We were able to provide $15 million from the settlement for housing counseling, for legal services, for other housing programs. We're going to be working with our colleagues in civil legal services all over New York State to make sure that no one in the state of New York is ever foreclosed on because they didn't have access to counsel. And we're going to be looking to creatively use the settlement funds to promote other important housing programs. The second thing is we do have a series of New York investigations that are underway that I started late last spring into various firms that were engaged in the pooling and securitization of mortgages back in the mortgage-backed securities bubble. And those are ongoing, and we're working hard on that. And the third thing is that starting at the very end of January, beginning of February, I was appointed by President Obama to be one of the co-chairs of a joint federal-state working group so that we can better coordinate our efforts to go after the misconduct that led to the bubble in the housing market and the mortgage-backed securities market that really brought the American economy to its knees. And I'm working with my colleagues in the Federal Department of Justice, the SEC, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, and others on coordinating our investigative activities. And I think this is a very important step. And I think and I'm working with attorneys general in other states as well. We have challenges going on to the MERS system, the shadow electronic registry that the banks set up so that they can know who owns the mortgage of the house, but you and I can't find out just by going to the county clerk's office anymore. There's a lot of aspects of what happened to the American mortgage system as it turned from a system where banks would lend you money and hold the mortgage till you paid them off. It turned into a securitization machine where the focus became getting as many mortgages as you can get, pouring them into securities, selling them off, and going to get more mortgages. There's a lot that happened as far as standards being weakened, and there's a lot of good work for us to do on investigating people who took things over the legal line. So we are actively going forward, looking forward to having results both in New York, some of my other colleagues bringing cases in other states, and our federal counterparts doing so as well between now and the end of the year.
Many Americans think that Wall Street has gotten away with murder. And I know you've been very active in trying to police the way in which the street operates. Anything you want to report to us?
Well, I think, look, the overwhelming majority of people in financial services, and I spent 15 years in private practice with a lot of clients that were in financial services, the overwhelming majority of people in financial services just want to make money for themselves and their clients. They need a clear set of rules, and they need to know that everyone's going to play by the rules. That's good for everybody. I think the problem is we went through this period of time where it became fashionable and politically acceptable to advocate for really what amounted to reckless deregulation. And you can look at the pattern over the last 15 years of actions taken that allowed us to get into the situation we did with the inflation of the mortgage-backed securities bubble, the decision not to regulate derivatives, a decision when in 2004 when states were clamoring for help with predatory lending, the Bush administration, in a bad use of preemption, which I talked about earlier, said, you can't do it. We're not going to even allow you to pass your own laws, and we're not going to pass a federal law. So you can see what happened, this atmosphere. And really, there are some folks who are still preaching this deregulatory ideology that really doesn't have any standards or parameters. And I think it's important to understand that financial markets work well when everyone understands that it's like a football game. You hit hard because everyone wants to hit hard in this business. But there are rules. There's a ref. When the whistle blows, you stop. It's not a street fight. And it's not like, when after the whistle blows, if you can sneak in another punch, that's good. Things really degenerated from a football game in which people made money, but there were rules that preserved the system for the long term.
Well, Eric Schneiderman, let me say good luck to you on that. I think a lot of us are behind you on it, and we hope that you succeed in it. Our guest on the Capital Connection has been New York State Attorney General Eric Schneiderman. Eric, we are very honored to have you here, and this microphone is always open to you whenever you want to come back.
Thank you very much, Alan. Always a pleasure.
The Capital Connection is distributed with the cooperation of the public radio stations of New York State. Ian Pickus is producer of The Capital Connection, a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in Albany. Support for The Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare online at nysut.org. and NISCASA, the New York State Coalition Against Sexual Assault, working to support men in their decisions to end sexual violence with the My Strength Is Not For Hurting campaign. Online at nyscasa.org.